screen starts glowing, and the film starts rolling. You wanna be knowing what you might be in for, so give the show a listen. In front of what you're missing, put yourself in position. But the instinct gets your
Hey, listeners, welcome to the 159th episode of The Goods, a Film Podcast. This is Dan, and I have Brian with me. You out there, Brian?
Hey, Dan. We got a varied offering today.
That's right. So this is a theme month. In fact, it is the middle episode of a theme month. Our theme months go 5 weeks long, 5 episodes long. And for this middle one, I wanted to do something sprawling and something film history oriented. I like to try and throw in some older stuff, especially during the theme months, kind of get a broader panorama of how a topic has been approached in film history. And here, I decided to take a look at 5 debut shorts for directors that I hold in high esteem. And I'm calling this little survey 5 Great American Minds. So it's 5 shorts, 5 different directors. And those 5 directors are D.W. Griffith, Steven Spielberg, Quentin Tarantino, Jim Henson, and then our own esteemed podcast host, Brian Terrell. Your debut short, if you want to call it that. I guess it was a student project for you. And I'm sure you'll be able to give us an overview on the making of this and what your role in it actually was, because I'm very curious to hear more about that. But we're going to talk through these 5 Great American Minds, Brian.
I'm excited. That's my new thing. If somebody says they're going to do a sampler platter, I always got to weasel one in there, like my wise man strategy. If I got something that'll fit the bill, put it on the marquee.
No, yeah, I was glad to throw some fun stuff on there. So, because I had forgotten about Henson's debut, which we had talked about a while ago. I don't know if on the pod we talked about it, but just in chat, you and I talked about it. And then always happy to talk about a Brian Terrell project. So the way we're going to structure this is if you've been listening to the theme month so far, you'll know that we have a series of questions we ask about the film and the director in question. And we'll be doing that for all 5 in chronological order. And so before we get started, I think I said this, these are all short films. I want to debut short films. Let's talk about short films in general, Brian, because on the one hand, it's just a film, but short, you know, but I think there's a lot of nuance and ways that a short is different from a feature film, the same way a short story has different objectives than a novel. And I also think the role of a short film has changed in the 21st century and in general over the course of film history. So I just wanted to open the floor and see if you had any thoughts on that.
I do. So a short film, it requires fewer resources, one of which is time, but another big one of which is money. So they can serve as a way to be a proof of concept, both in terms of proving the concept of like a story or a script, but also of the creative team itself. So it's a way that you cut your teeth is make the short first and then get people to see it. Ideally, people who can put you onto more expensive and funded projects.
And that's kind of historically been the role of the short, or at least a role of a short film. Now, experienced directors make short films too, and there's different reasons they might do that. But I think you see a lot that great directors had either student projects or first films that went around the festival circuit being shorts. Because like you said, you can show off your skill with a much smaller commitment, you know?
It's like you really got to have people behind you before you can muster up, like, even $200,000 or $400,000 or something to make a feature, you know.
And I think in one of our examples, the short film, it's really short is not the correct term because in the early years of cinema, everything went on reels. So you would either have a one reel short or a two reel short.
That's a great point. And a reel is like 11 minutes, 10 or 11 minutes.
Right. So like Griffith's first film is a one reeler, I believe. We'll talk about that. But features were just less common. And usually, you know, you'd have the whole format where you'd have some shorts and then one long feature, and you'd like get a whole day pass kind of to go to a theater. And you'd get your news that way too, because they'd have news reels and things like that. So in the case of at least this first one that we're going to talk about, that was just like the default format of these film companies was, hey, here's a one reel film. That's an 11 minute film. You know, that's just like an accepted commercial format. Whereas the rest of them, I think all of the other ones are either like showing off skills or like, well, the Henson one, I think is kind of different.
It's like trying a different medium than you're associated with.
Yeah.
And I think in recent years, short films have maybe blossomed again because of the streaming formats. Like, we're less married to feature length and half hour or 1 hour TV programs. You can have a showcase of shorts. You could have like an anthology or just be watching clips. And there's just such a proliferation of various niche festivals. Like, I love going to the DC Shorts Festival in the fall, which is exclusively short films.
I've never been to that, but that sounds pretty cool.
And of course, there's Oscar noms for shorts, live action shorts, and animated shorts. So it's still an industry. But I also want to talk a little bit, Dan, about what defines a short film beyond the length. Like, is any YouTube video that's 10 minutes long, is that a short film?
It's a really good question, and I don't think it has a concrete answer. For me, a short film is something that is like deliberately designed to be a standalone thing that could be viewed either by itself or with a package of other shorts or something. But that's distinct from a YouTube video, which is like an entry in a channel. And even if it's like, you know, some YouTube makers, their all their videos are like little skits that don't necessarily have like a unifying thread or personality across the videos, but it's still kind of in the context of the channel being the unit rather than the film itself being the unit. And I think it gets blurry. I think there are some cases where you say, oh, well, he just makes short movies, but he publishes them on YouTube as opposed to he has a YouTube channel. I think it blends, but I think another piece of it is like if it's also part of the overall machinery of movie making in the movie world rather than just in the digital content YouTube world. And sometimes on Letterboxd, you see YouTube videos posted there as if they are films, whether short or feature length. In the case of some of those epic, like documentary type things that you sometimes see, occasionally those get listed on Letterboxd too. Like the one about the Disney World or Disneyland park or something is on there.
Fast Pass.
Yeah, that's it.
I mean, the whole channel is various Disney attractions, but I think the one that really broke through into broader knowledge was the Fast Pass documentary.
I think it's a good point, and it's an interesting phenomenon whenever the creation and the distribution of art becomes more widespread, is like you get a mix of much better stuff, but also a lot more of less good stuff too, if that makes sense. Like you see this in classical music where you would go from a period that where like the Baroque period where music was only really performed at like courts and stuff. And it was very sophisticated and intricate and like harder to kind of understand and had a sort of highfalutin air about it. That's like the Bach era. And then you shift over to the classical era, the Haydn era, Mozart. He's obviously a little different. This was what they just call the classical era. And this is when they started performing music in concert halls all across Europe. And a bunch of them were built. Tickets were cheap to get in. And so now all of a sudden, it was much more accessible for people to hear music. But because it was much more accessible for people to make it and for people to hear it, there was a lot more of it made, and it was kind of appealed to a lower common denominator, like a lower artistic ambition, I guess. And there's some debate about how much truth there is in that, like, oh, just because it's a simpler form doesn't necessarily mean it's less good or less ambitious or less valuable. And I think that's true, but I think you kind of see this like in indie cinema in the 2000s, for example, when you could get a camera for less than $1,000 and you could make a whole movie for less than $10,000 as a result, because a digital video camera could basically do all of it for you. You saw a proliferation of stuff of varying quality that was just easier to produce, you know? And I think it kind of comes in ebbs and flows in terms of like, when is it reached a sweet spot of being both accessible, but also good mechanisms to get the talent to the top, the separate the wheat from the chaff, et cetera. And that's part of my problem with YouTube is like, to me, it's just all just this huge vortex of content. Like, unless I hear about something outside of YouTube, I'm not going to go watch it on YouTube. Like, I need it to be separately recommended to me for me to spend my time watching it.
A few things about what you just said, because it's all good stuff. But yeah, like my dad, like he'll leave the autoplay on and he'll just watch whatever comes up. And I think, how can you do that? How can you do that to yourself? It's like, no, somebody tells you this so-and-so is good. And then you start watching that channel. That's the accepted way. And you don't have to watch everything they do. It's like pick and choose a little bit. Like you're at a restaurant. They don't just put a hose in your mouth.
Right, exactly.
But also, yes, the bar to entry only gets lower. The equipment moves from professional to prosumer to consumer, and then everybody's got a 4K camera in their pocket that they're carrying around. So on the one hand, it makes it easier and easier to make a movie. On the other hand, more and more and more people are making movies. So very hard to make the product stand out, whereas maybe in the past it was easier. It was harder to make the movie, but the handful of people who were making movies, they had a smaller pond that they were swimming in.
Right. Yeah. And I think there's always positives and there's always drawbacks, you know, because I think, I don't know, I have some theory. I'll wait until we talk about Tarantino for my theory about why we had a golden age of directors that came up through the indie boom of the early and mid 90s. But why don't we just dive into it? So we'll start with D.W. Griffith. His first film came out in 1908. It's called The Adventures of Dolly. So what is this person best known for and what is our experience with them? So D.W. Griffith is most famous by far for making the first great American film that is also a racist piece of trash, and that is The Birth of a Nation from 1915. It is widely credited with basically inventing, or if not inventing, then codifying like cinematic language. And the next movie he made was called Intolerance. And that is typically what you see ranked as his best movie these days, because people don't want to put the racist one up on a pedestal, because The Birth of a Nation is not run-of-the-mill racist. It's like aggressively, disgustingly racist. Have you ever actually watched it, Brian?
I've watched Birth of a Nation, yeah, all the way through, and it's pretty long.
It's 3 hours.
One of the things it's credited as is like being the first blockbuster, if not the first feature. Like, there's other claimants to that, but pretty squarely a lot of people say it's the first blockbuster, and yeah, it's like a roadshow 3-hour production. First epic. I have not seen Intolerance, but I know that that one is, it's like almost an anthology film. There's scenes taking place in different eras, right? And different parts of the world.
Intolerance probably has the most epic scope of any movie I've ever seen. It's maybe Cloud Atlas. I don't know. Even then though, like if just talking about the production values, I think Intolerance tops them all, tops Titanic in terms of scope. It's set across 4 different timelines, with like a fifth one being this shot of like a woman rocking a cradle that it'll show her and then jump to another time. There is one in Babylon. There's one in Jesus's time. There's one in, I think it's the French Revolution. I can't remember what the third one is. And then the fourth one is pretty close to the time it was made, which I think was 1916, the women's suffrage movement. And it's particularly the scenes set in Babylon are just, oh my God, it's like a cast of thousands. They built like an entire town square with these huge arches and stuff, like the equivalent of millions and millions of dollars worth of stuff for today. And it's really something. And, you know, he did so much, like just the pattern. It's really stuff that we kind of take for granted today, but like the pattern of establishing shot, showing where the setting is, zooming into the specific people, showing the face of the person who is the subject, cutting back to the face of the person who needs to react. Like those are kind of all things that we just don't even think about when we watch a movie. That's just how we watch a movie and how we know how to read the story and the setting. But like before that, they just literally put a camera somewhere and let it act out as if like we were watching a stage play. I know some people were experimenting with that stuff, but Griffith is the one who really pulled it all together. And it's a real, like, even today, I think it kind of stands up, especially if you're looking at it from the lens of like, he didn't necessarily have all this precedent. It really is impressive to watch, but if only it weren't so racist, you know, like if only it weren't the story of the KKK rising, the black people being like coming in from the north, taking over in the southern town, being like sloppy, stinky people who then like essentially try to capture
prey on the white women.
Yeah.
Where are the white women at?
And it's aggressively implied, you know, rape and kill the white women too, you know?
Right. If you watch one scene from that movie, I would recommend the assassination of Abraham Lincoln scene. Like, I think that pretty much captures it. And like, there were probably people alive then who remembered the Lincoln assassination.
Everyone who made that movie is dead now. It's crazy. It's like, I don't know, you know, film's a recent enough medium that like many of the important figures of it are still alive. But then you go back this far and like, that is multiple generations ago at this point. It's over 100 years ago. So, and I think Griffith has faded both for a bunch of reasons. I mean, one is the complicated legacy of Birth of a Nation and then his subsequent movies. I've seen a bunch of Griffith movies. I mean, I think you gotta see the defining ones, which are Birth of a Nation and then Intolerance. They're long. They're tough to sit through. You could probably watch them on 1.5x if you're impatient. But I've seen a couple of his other ones. And the one that I really liked was Broken Blossoms from 1919, which is about a young woman maybe coded to be underage. It's debatable. There's not really consensus on this. But anyways, this young woman has an abusive dad and she runs off to basically Chinatown and sort of moves in with this shopkeeper who takes care of her and nurses her back to health after she gets beat up really bad. And then basically the dad finds out about it and it kind of comes to a confrontation. And it's much more intimate, much less epic than the other ones, done on a smaller budget. And I actually found its emotions pretty appealing, whereas I tend to find Griffith very patronizing in general and like how he's, what he's saying and the stories he's telling. But I really liked Broken Blossoms. That's the one that maybe stands up the best out of his. And I think also if you go back to like early film history, like when people were first starting to talk about film history, I actually have this book from, I think it was printed in the 50s. It's right here. I'm going to read a passage from it. Griffith, people just like kind of penciled in automatically that he was the greatest director of all time and invented movies. And we like know that's not true now, especially because so much was going on in Europe. But it's kind of weird how his legacy has kind of fallen from being like the shoo-in greatest of all time who invented it to like a complicated figure who made important contributions, but like simultaneously to other people. And now we've kind of disowned him to some extent because of all of the complications of that. So it's kind of interesting. I don't know.
Yeah. Another thing that D.W. Griffith did was he was one of the co-founders of United Artists. He worked together with Charlie Chaplin and Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks to kind of create their own studio with the founding principle that it was going to be run by the artists, not the business people. the actors and the directors, they're the ones in charge. Of course, that studio doesn't exist anymore as far as I know. It got subsumed into one of the monoliths.
I mean, I think it's a good point, though. And, you know, he's basically pushing back against the Edison monopoly, where they were just churned out, you know, Nickelodeons or whatever, like just trash to be consumed. And I think there's something admirable in that. But before we talk about it, sure, I just really quickly want to read this one passage. And by the way, this book has like 10 pages on Griffith, and like seven of them are about The Birth of a Nation. But here's the passage from, it's called Just the Movies by Simon and Schuster. Between 1909 and 1916, David Wark Griffith created the art of screen narrative almost single-handed. After Intolerance, there was no significant addition to film syntax until the advent of sound and of the widescreen, both mechanical rather than artistic innovations, although, of course, they affect the art. Acknowledging his influence, Cecil B. DeMille recently said that there is something of Griffith in every film made since his day. His contemporaries regarded him with awe, called him the master, and predicted an unlimited future for him after what was thought of as a temporary and accidental failure of Intolerance, which made a lot less money than Birth of a Nation. Yet this enigmatic and somewhat tragic figure never fully succeeded in delivering what he had to say through the medium of which he was the virtual creator. His dream of picturing a vast screen mosaic on the American and French revolutions and the birth of modern liberty was incompletely realized. Neither Orphans of the Storm from 1922 or America from 1924 achieved the impact or acclaim of Birth of a Nation. And this book came out in, 1957. So 40 years after Birth of a Nation, but, you know, at this point, almost 65 years ago, more than 65 years ago. So the kind of hushed, odd tones that people now use for, like, I don't know, Hitchcock and Spielberg, you know. Anyways, how old was this person at the time of their debut and what is their background? So Griffith was 33 in 1908 when he made his first film, and he was born a classic post-war rural Southerner in Kentucky. He actually went to school in a one-room schoolhouse, like kind of the stereotypical rural guy. And he wanted to write. He wrote plays when he was young. And at one point, he took a trip to New York to make a sales pitch on one of his scripts. And he got a meeting with Edwin S. Porter, the guy who made Great Train Robbery, which we talked about back in Train Month. Porter did not buy the script, but he's like, oh, you could act if you want to act, and gave him an acting gig. And so Griffith decided to stick around New York City. By the way, like very early in film history, New York City was the hub of the film industry, not Hollywood.
I'm glad you name dropped Edwin S. Porter. He also was very influential early on. I guess we talked about it back in the train episode with Great Train Robbery, but like a lot of continuity editing principles, Edwin Porter originated.
Right. Yeah, Great Train Robbery was maybe not the first ever example of cross-cutting continuity where you have at the same time two locations and you go back and forth between them, which again is something like you don't even think about today. That's just like part of stories that you watch on screen, but was innovative and complicated at the time. But eventually befriended a cameraman and through that got his first gig with Biograph Films. And the company was like wanting to increase output. And so they basically hired him to make this first film. Brian, you sent me a funny quote from the Wikipedia article. The Biograph company needed another director as it was planning to increase its output to two films per week.
Two films a week.
That's crazy.
Studios just don't keep that pace anymore.
Yeah. And his first film, 1908, is called The Adventures of Dolly. So what happens in this movie is it's kind of set on the frontier, and it follows this frontier family. They're approached by these aggressive Romani merchants who try to sell them some wares, and they get turned down, but like this makes the merchants really mad, and they kidnap the daughter named Dolly. That's The Adventures of Dolly. That's the daughter. And they like hide her in a barrel when the family comes searching for her. Really cruel stuff. She's got to be like a 6-year-old or something like that. And the merchants are like running off with her, and they accidentally drop this barrel into a river. It's just kind of bobbing up and down in the river. The barrel is found by a fisher boy and by Dolly's father. And luckily, Dolly is unharmed and returned to her family. So it's this little 9-minute single reel story. And it has a lot of what I would think of Griffith's stories being.
It's the perils of a white maiden at the hands of an insidious minority.
Exactly.
The whole thing is a PSA. Keep your kids away from gypsies.
Exactly. Yeah. And it feels very patronizing, but it also has pretty cool shots and just pretty instinctive kind of flow to the story within 9 minutes, at least relative to the time, you know, no intertitles. So like no text bits in there. So it manages to convey all this with just the images, which is pretty cool. And like that would not be the norm. So I liked that a lot. I thought it showed good visual language.
Right. It flows well. It's easy to follow. The editing is clear, A to B to C, and you follow the barrel along. And one of the YouTube comments pointed out that they like set up the barrel early on. Like you see it. Oh, what's going to happen with the barrel?
Yeah, it kind of catches your eye. Any other thoughts on this one before we ask a couple other questions about D.W. Griffith, Brian?
I think calling it an adventure is a choice. Is this an adventure? Maybe a misadventure.
When did I say adventure?
No, that's the title of the film.
Oh.
The Adventure of Dolly.
You're right, yeah. Adventure is, I think of that as more positive than what she has to go through. Literally being kidnapped, gagged, and shoved in a barrel. Tossed into a river. It's going to cause her lifelong trauma. How much does this work foreshadow and represent their future work, and how doesn't it? I think we kind of talked about that. And the one thing it lacks that you would see with his epics is just the huge scale of the production and the sprawling size of the cast and the story. But you do get a sense of what he's able to do. What is the legacy and reputation of this debut? Other than just being his first, and he actually got to pair with the cameraman named G.W. Bitzer, who paired with him on a bunch of different stuff as sort of his like lieutenant. I don't know if he was always credited as the cinematographer or as the cameraman or whatever, but he was kind of like the second in command. And so now I guess, what is your favorite work by Griffith? Have you seen anything beyond Birth of a Nation, Brian?
I would have to look at a list. It's probably just that I've seen. I may have seen another one of his shorts if he was cranking out one a week, but yeah, that's the one I associate with him.
It just casually says, after he made this first one, he made 48 more for them this year. What the? 48 movies in a year? That's crazy.
Wow. And I guess, would you say Intolerance is your recommended pick? Or you pointed out that Broken something.
Blossoms. I think Intolerance or Broken Blossoms. And I think it's interesting. Like, I wonder if Birth of a Nation had somehow managed to do the things it did technically without being in service of actively destructive, like worsening the quality of American culture story. Then I feel like that would probably be an easy pick for his greatest film and like one of the greatest films of all time. But I just can't sit through it. I would give that a 2 out of 8. I'd give Intolerance, from a, like a modernized perspective, probably like a 5 out of 8, and Broken Blossoms either a 5 or a 6, because they do hold up pretty well with the really interesting stuff in there. And honestly, like within context of the time period and what the expectations were then, probably an even higher rating. So, yeah. And what will we check out next by D.W. Griffith, Brian?
Someday I'm going to get to Intolerance. The runtime, especially for a silent movie, is an impediment to me, but I'll get there. Are you going to check out some of those 48 that he cranked out within the course of 1908, Dan?
I think the one that I want to see is, there's one called The Avenging Conscience that he made in 1914. So it was before Birth of a Nation. And the poster always looks badass. It's like death is involved and murder is involved. The poster is pretty cool. It's a skeleton creeping up on a man. There's also one called The Musketeers of Pig Alley, which was like a breakthrough in popularity for him. That was 1912 that I haven't seen and I'd be curious about too. So that's D.W. Griffith. We're going through five. So we're on to the next one. And this one takes us from the 19-aughts to the 1960s with Steven Spielberg's debut film. If you can call it that, because if you watch the Fablemans, you know that Steven Spielberg was making movies since he was like a kid, since he was 12 years old or something like that. And this is a short film called Amblin, which you also may recognize as the name of his production company. He adopted it from the name of his short film. So what is Steven Spielberg best known for and what is our experience with him?
Well, Steven Spielberg has done a lot of things, Dan, as I'm sure you're aware.
Many of the biggest movies of all time, generally very well regarded pieces of popcorn entertainment, but also like with real merit in their craft. And he also has made art films. He made Munich. He made Best Picture winner.
Schindler's List, not Fiddler's List. I combined it with Fiddler on the Roof for a moment there. Different movie, same ethnic group.
Saving Private Ryan, Jurassic Park, Jaws. So many great ones. And he's still working, man. I really liked Fablemans, which was his autobiographical one. I haven't seen The West Side Story, but that looks interesting. And yeah, whenever he makes something, it's still a big deal. So he probably has, in the eye of the modern viewer, one of the richest and most accessible filmographies of any great director, I would say. I don't think that's a controversial statement.
He was also credited with inventing or reinventing the blockbuster.
Right, with Jaws particularly. So he made Amblin when he was 22 years old, and he grew up, you know, most of this will not be new to you if you watched Fablemans, but he grew up in Cincinnati and then moved to Phoenix. His grandparents were Ukrainian Jews, and his parents got divorced. Both of those things have kind of defined a lot of his film output. As a teenager, he made amateur films with his friends on 8mm camera. When he was 17, he made a feature-length film. 17, Brian. That's crazy. It's called Firelight, and it kind of served as the basis for Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh, man. Why didn't we watch that? I didn't even know about that.
I don't know. Yeah, but he basically rented out a theater to show it and charged tickets. And he borrowed $500 to make it. And then from the box office, he made $501. So it was a profit of $1 on the film.
A lot of people don't achieve that. So,
yeah, seriously. But then he decided to go to college in L.A. And while he was there, he met some executives who worked at Universal and they liked him and they offered him like odd jobs around the studio to basically kind of apprentice on making movies. And then a year later, he made a short film. And then when he showed it to the people at Universal, they're like, "We think you got talent, kid. We're going to give you a 7-year contract."
A 7-year contract off of this.
Yeah, mostly TV shows, but then he turned it obviously into feature length films, too.
Yeah, I mean, he's Mr. Universal Studios. Or he was back before Harry Potter Land, and the theme park model has kind of subsequently changed to like experiencing realms more so than riding particular movies.
Because his movie is made for perfect rides. Yeah. I loved when I went to Universal. I was like, oh, like when you step into Jurassic Park land or ride or whatever, and like the music comes swelling in and there's like dinosaur statues. It's like, oh, so good.
Right. And there's a Jaws pier and the E.T. forest. And
right. So this story, Amblin, it's entirely dialogue free. Actually, looking at it, Brian, three of the five we're going to talk about today are entirely dialogue-free, and one of them is entirely dialogue. One of them is a flip of that. But it follows a young man who's trying to hitch a ride to some unknown destination, and he crosses path with a young woman who's doing the same. And we then follow them through a series of like sketches, little adventures or misadventures, as you might say. They kind of go across the countryside, and one night, they hook up, they become a romantic item. And finally, they reach their destination, which is kind of like this metaphoric end of the road. They've reached the coastline, the end of the nation. And it's clearly a Pacific beach. I think it's not too hard to project some of like Spielberg's life story onto this, where he gradually moved west and it found himself in LA. And when the man gets there, he's overjoyed to get there. He like runs and jumps into the ocean, but the woman is clearly we see from her face, ambivalent about this. She peeks into like his things. I think he's carrying them in like a guitar case, and the stuff that he's got in there is not like very free spirited stuff. It's like suburban possessions. He's got like a suit, and he's got like stomach medicine and grooming stuff. And she seems disappointed by this, and she leaves the beach, presumably could continue wandering herself. And the man kind of catches one last glimpse of her walking off before the film ends.
Never let her see your stomach medicine. We'll give her the ick.
I thought this was pretty interesting. You can see some of his knack for really interesting compositions and like the lighting, like cool stuff with sunsets and stuff in terms of how it foreshadows their future work. I mean, he's clearly ramping up, but you can see the germ, the seed of like what would become Raiders of the Lost Ark. I like how we're like several minutes into talking about his career and we're just keep tossing out popcorn film masterpieces that he's made. He's had such a huge career.
For sure. Yeah, I didn't think Indy got the name drop when you were listing things before, so I'm glad it came out. Where do you see the Raiders of the Lost Ark? I see there's some sand, obviously, because they're on like a beach. There is cool like sunset stuff.
Yeah, with like silhouettes and like framing someone journeying across something. I got a little bit of Indy there.
And there's some cool like superposition of shots where you can like see through a half opaque layer and see underneath it, and the two shots are framed so that they kind of mesh, which is nice composition. But this is by far the longest of the shorts we watched. It's like 25 minutes compared to everything else is under 10. And with no dialogue and them just driving in a car along the beach, I was looking at my watch.
Oh, you weren't vibing with it too much. Okay. Interesting. I'll be curious to hear what your Is It Good rating is on this. What's the legacy and reputation of this debut? Well, I had never heard of this prior to me looking up what was Steven Spielberg's debut for debut month and seeing Amblin there. I think obviously it's meaningful to him. It informed the name of his studio. And I think you see, like I said, bits of his filmmaking instinct there. And just the fact that he had been kind of grinding at making films since he was a kid, he's just got some knack for it that you can tell. But I think you're also right that it's almost just like a showcase of like little ideas and sketches and shots that he's capable of putting those together rather than anything that's of too much value in itself. Although the ending is kind of like metaphoric. Like it had me wondering more. It felt almost avant-garde, like what was going on there. Whereas the rest is just like a little adventure, road adventure, you know?
I did kind of like the ending because, so this was 1968, like hippie era. And this downbeat ending where it's like they're dreaming and the dream takes them to California. And then it kind of splinters and falls apart. I feel like that's kind of what happened to the hippie movement. And it wasn't even over yet in 1968.
Oh, that's interesting. I like the hippie connection on that. Yeah, because he's also like tapping into what's going on in the zeitgeist.
Yeah, just this story of them hitchhiking across the country is a very like Texas Chainsaw Massacre vibe, except that's not the route they go down.
Right.
Or like Manson Family, but also not that vibe either.
Yeah, it's like hitchhiking would basically become synonymous with serial killers. So what is your favorite work by Spielberg?
There's a lot of choices.
I know.
And I like a lot of them. We've talked about a few. I'll pencil in Raiders right now, Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's probably the answer, but I enjoy a lot of them. I mean, to think that he did Jurassic Park and Schindler's List in the same year.
It's crazy.
What about you, Dan?
Yeah, it's kind of like impossible to talk about because it's just so, he's just made so goddamn many delightful films. And even like the, oh, what about the gem blank? You can go like 15 deep on that, you know? Like he, if you pull up Letterboxd, he has a film that was nominated for Best Picture that is his 25th most popular film on the site. The Color Purple, nominated for Best Picture, 25th most popular film on Letterboxd.
So goddamn many delightful films. That could be the title for this episode.
I think the indies are a good call. I'll shout out Catch Me If You Can, Saving Private Ryan. And then if you really want a curveball in there, and nobody said that there needed to be a curveball, but I'm going to throw one out there anyways. Anytime that he and Tom Hanks cross paths, I'm on board. So The Terminal is like, it's kind of weird. He made like his loosest, goofiest movie that has like serious 9/11 undertones. And like in any other hand would be a serious film. But Spielberg was like, oh, I'm just going to make it a goofy comedy with Tom Hanks doing an inscrutable Eastern European accent.
Krakosia. Krakosia.
All right. What, if anything, by Spielberg do we plan to check out next?
There's definitely gaps I need to fill. I might watch Munich next. I've never seen that one.
I do like Munich. It's a little artier than some of his other stuff, but still exciting. Jaws for me. I just got to go bite the bullet and go see Jaws. Not that that's like a bite the bullet type experience, but yeah.
It's better than Piranha 2.
I'll believe you on that. Moving on. Quentin Tarantino. We went from 1968 to 1991. So in 1991, Quentin Tarantino released at Sundance a short of Reservoir Dogs. So not the actual Reservoir Dogs, but the short that would become it. And this is another thing you sometimes see with short films where they're like a kind of a prototype for what would become the feature length. Two other really famous versions of that, Whiplash, the Damien Chazelle one, and Bottle Rocket, the first Wes Anderson movie. Also both at Sundance, by the way. So what is Quentin Tarantino best known for, Brian?
Probably Pulp Fiction, but there are a few big ones. He doesn't do them all that often. It's like a few years go by in between a movie. So then whenever he does come out with one, I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was his 9th film, I think, because Hateful Eight was number 8. So it's like each time one comes, it's an event. My favorite is Inglourious Basterds. What about you? What's your perception's biggest thing that he's known for?
So I think if you're talking specific films, Pulp Fiction is his most famous. He's famously said he only wants to make 10 movies, and that requires a little bit of stretching, like Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2 need to be one movie, for example. And his 10th movie, which he claims will be his last, is going to be called The Movie Critic. So we'll see how that one turns out. I've seen maybe 4 of them. I've seen Pulp Fiction, Inglourious Basterds, Reservoir Dogs, and I feel like there's one other.
Did you see Django?
I did not see Django. So maybe I've only seen 3, is that right? Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and Inglourious? I guess that is right. So I haven't seen Jackie Brown, I haven't seen Django, haven't seen The Kill Bills or Hateful Eight or Grindhouse.
Did you watch From Dusk Till Dawn in your Rodriguez onslaught?
No, I should have, but I didn't.
I think you'd like From Dusk Till Dawn.
But I think in terms of like bigger picture rather than specific films, he ushered in a new indie era where like there was both big money and critical interest in indie movies. And that was really kicked off with Reservoir Dogs. And then Pulp Fiction 2 years later kind of opened the floodgates. And there's like a batch of directors from basically 1992, when Reservoir Dogs debuted, up through, let's say, the end of the 90s, that kind of just followed in his wake, not like stylistically specifically, but just kind of opening the door for, oh, hold on, these indie directors are the real deal. Like P.T. Anderson did that. The Coen brothers did that. Sofia Coppola, Wes Anderson, Alexander Payne, who made Sideways and who made the big one this year, The Holdovers. So I think like he's kind of associated with a certain type of indie movie filmmaking, and a lot of his tropes specifically, like the way that he wrote dialogue first, very stylish. And this, like, you'd have a lot of dialogue that isn't directly touching on it, but is very kind of pattery, comes in really quickly and has kind of a flow to it, I think was also really influential.
Definitely. That's what jumped out to me in this short, because there wasn't really much else to it. But in like the first time that I sat down and watched Pulp Fiction, the Tarantino dialogue really sticks out. I believe we've talked about it before, but it's like, it sounds realistic in the sense of these are the things that people actually talk about. But then like distilled down to everything that somebody says is sharp and witty and interesting.
And has a rhythm to it too, yeah. So he was 28 when he made this. He grew up in LA in a lower middle class family. And he started writing scripts at 14. And actually early in his career, he was mostly known as a writer, whereas now he's kind of like an auteur in general. But he dropped out of high school and he famously worked as a video store clerk for like 5 or 6 years. The store he worked at is called Video Archives, which is now famous because he put it on the map, basically.
And once he made his Hollywood money, the video store went out of business and he bought it and all their old inventory. So now he's just got stacks of videotapes in his basement or something.
Yeah, he recreated it in his basement, yeah. And I think he also named his podcast Video Archives, which is cool. He kind of would work some low-level showbiz jobs. Like, he was an Elvis impersonator on Golden Girls, which is kind of funny. And at one point, he was just at a friend's barbecue, and a movie producer happened to be there. And Tarantino told him about this idea for a script he was working on that was a heist movie, but entirely driven by dialogue rather than the heist action itself. And the producer basically encouraged him to make it, to write the script, which he did. And then the producer got it in the hands of Harvey Keitel, who really liked this, ended up being the Reservoir Dogs script, and basically came on as a producer and started basically pushing it through. That's when Tarantino made it as a short. Now, I think the short was always intended to just be a prototype for a feature, but that Sundance Talent Lab, they had like a whole program where they would support up and coming directors. Would just, like I said, be really remarkable for allowing like these incredible young talents to basically come in totally fresh with their vision intact. And that, I think, is one of the golden age of the short, is where you had these people who were hungry and just chomping at the bit. It wasn't that widespread yet, but like they were ready to do it. And then finally there was like a way for them to do it cheaply and get some exposure with the improving tech and Sundance really highlighting indie directors and stuff. So I think that's cool.
This short, I've not seen anything quite like it because it's almost a community theater staging of Reservoir Dogs. Like they're on these flat sets going through their lines and it's not really like one scene leads into the next. It's kind of like disconnected scenes from the movie.
Yeah, it's like a really condensed version of the feature film, but like just scenes in isolation with no real ending.
It's like your summer theater camp announces they're going to do Reservoir Dogs.
Not recommended for under the age of 18. But Steve Buscemi is in it, and Quentin Tarantino is the other main actor in it. And then there's one other actor who I didn't recognize as the third key point. But we see before the movie that the other actor is like the honcho organizing it. And then we smash cut to the aftermath, just like in Reservoir Dogs. And there's someone shot and they're arguing about how the heist went wrong. And yeah, just kind of like a 10-minute microcosm, very unpolished version of what Reservoir Dogs would actually be.
But the dialogue is pretty much verbatim in the finished film when those scenes come up.
And Buscemi is great.
Steve Buscemi is so good. Like, he was a big get. I looked up a little about him, and I guess he'd already been doing movies for a while when he was in this. So it's not a case where Quentin Tarantino necessarily discovered him. But it was interesting that Buscemi was a New York-based actor.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah. I wonder, but Tarantino was in L.A. I wonder if Keitel was the link there. I imagine he must have been.
I guess in this short, Tarantino is in the role of Mr. White, who is one of the most prominent characters, and it ends up being the character who Keitel plays in the finished film.
Oh, yeah.
Very good decision not to have Tarantino play this part. Give it to Keitel instead, because Tarantino, he just doesn't have the acting chops.
He's such a goober. He's so weird. He's definitely not a professional actor. He's probably better than some non-professional actors, but he's still just gives off a energy that is not at all natural, you know?
I thought it was pretty funny that he is killed off screen almost immediately in the finished film.
Yeah. The only like outstanding actor in the feature length Reservoir Dogs, but it doesn't really matter because he gets like 3 minutes of screen time because then he gets killed. Yeah.
But I read somewhere recently that great actors, you want to hear the next thing they're going to say. And I think Steve Buscemi certainly falls into that category. Like, I liked hearing him talk.
I agree. It's rumored that Tom Cruise is looking at a role in The Movie Critic, the 10th Tarantino, which would be awesome if it happened. And when he is on, when Tom Cruise is on, he has that exact thing where you're hanging on his every single word. Like if you watch A Few Good Men, I would love to see what he does with some Tarantino dialogue, even in this this later state of Cruise's career.
Yeah, I'm thinking of him in Tropic Thunder, where he's like the greasy agent guy.
That would be a fun one to talk about at some point, yeah. How much does this work foreshadow and represent their future work, and how doesn't it? I think it very much does, in that it's got like this, we talked about the dialogue being the driver, and even the characterization of like these, they're kind of intimidating, but they're also kind of losers, criminals, talking about everyday things, and they're kind of medium level competence, I would say. That's kind of like a through line in a lot of Tarantino's stuff. And there's sort of like an arch operatic quality to the dialogue.
Yeah, bumbling crooks.
Yeah.
I had not seen the feature Reservoir Dogs before this week, so after I watched the short, I did go watch that so I could kind of understand what was happening. And I didn't know the scene where the guy is dancing around and shaking the gasoline tank on the tied up dude. Like, I knew that from an Itchy and Scratchy on The Simpsons.
That's the one where he cuts off the ear. It's kind of gnarly.
Although it got a little squeamish. It was like the camera looked away as he was cutting the ear off and then looks back. But then you do get to see the ear hole. So
good makeup, yeah.
Yeah, we got to see it in the end.
What is your favorite work by this director? You said for you, it's Inglourious. For me, it's probably Pulp Fiction. I would have that in my top 100 films. I don't know if I have any other by him in the top 100, but I haven't disliked any movies I've seen by him.
Yep. Overall, they're pretty strong. I don't know if I like Django as much as the other ones that I've seen, but Pulp Fiction, quite good. Really like Inglourious Bastards.
I'll definitely do a watch through of his filmography before The Movie Critic comes out, probably in chronological order. And is there anything else that you want to check out next by him, Brian?
Maybe Kill Bill. I don't know. You got a recommendation for me? I haven't seen all that many either. I guess you've only seen three.
Well, a lot of people say Jackie Brown is like quietly his best movie. So that's one I'm excited to check out too. All right. We're through three, Brian. On to number four of our five great American minds. And this is Jim Henson. We were going from, I didn't do it in chronological order because this would have actually been second.
Right.
1967. I kind of lost the thread there.
That's how I had it in my notes, but I thought maybe because I added these, you put them at the end.
Well, that's exactly what happened. I had my three.
It's not the pure episode. It's a cancerous growth.
Imagine that we're talking about this one before Steven Spielberg, audience, because this actually came out 1 year before Steven Spielberg's Amblin. And this is Jim Henson's Timepiece. So what is this person best known for, and what is our experience with them? And I'll let you lead on this one, Brian, because I know you got some strong Henson feelings.
Right. So I'm big into Jim Henson. Obviously, he's the man who brought the Muppets into the world. I recently went to an exhibit on Henson's life at a museum in Baltimore. And it was a traveling exhibit, so it's been at a lot of museums. But they had a special section all about his connection to Maryland. And he was a lot more local to this area than I realized, because he did go to the University of Maryland, and his first Muppet project was a TV show out of a DC-based local television station. And he started doing the show when he was in high school. So he was going in, working at a TV station, broadcasting the Muppets when he was like 17.
It's crazy. Yeah. And he kind of had like a gradual upward grind or trajectory, I guess. So he took like a puppetry and textile class, I think in high school, and he basically used that, like you said, in his high school job on a TV station,
Right. So, yeah, in the exhibit, it had like a little case. It's like, these are the two books he checked out of the library when he decided that he wanted to make a puppet.
It's crazy. And like, he started doing, like you said, a little show that was sketches. And then he got invited to like variety shows and talk shows.
And he did a lot of commercials that used the puppets as well.
And he kind of was grinding on that through the 60s and like getting more and more of a reputation, more and more opportunities. And so this film came out in 1967, which he was doing in between all of his various puppetry stuff as he was kind of inventing the Muppets at this point. So this one's totally different from the Muppets. There's no puppets involved in this. It's called Timepiece. And this is unlike anything I've ever seen by Henson. What about you, Brian?
Right. I didn't know about this before I was at that exhibit, and they had like an experimental room, and they were broadcasting the family-friendly part of this short on a wall where it is Henson, and he's in like a suit and top hat, and he's just sprinting through a field.
Right.
All the reviews on Letterboxd are about young Henson being really hot, apparently.
He is a handsome guy, yeah. So this is like another wordless film. And I would kind of put it in the experimental or like avant-garde. Henson is the lead as well as the director. And I think the most interesting element of it is the editing in combination with the sound. So the soundscape is really interesting. It's like this metronomic rhythms and like sound effects coming in at a steady rhythm. Like it starts with the beating of a heart, but then it like grows from there.
It's kind of like a snare drum, like boom, ta-da-boom, ta-da-boom, ta-da-boom. And the rhythm motivates the cuts.
And so the story opens with this man played by Henson in a hospital bed. And we see a doctor from behind. He finds the heartbeat on Henson and that kind of sets the rhythm, like I said, like the sound. And then we now kind of start jumping around this man living an everyday life. It's intercut with like bits of kind of mixed media collage, like these blocks of color and stuff, and just lots of surreality and abstraction. Like, and sometimes it'll hop between timelines and mise-en-scenes to like emphasize certain ideas or things, like, oh, when he's racing across the street, it like cuts to him being Tarzan swinging across a jungle and just things like that. It kind of follows him through a day and culminates with him going to a burlesque club or a strip club. And there he starts drinking and then it kind of explodes into full on surrealism. Lots of sexual imagery at this point too. What do you think of this end section, Brian?
Yeah, there's a lot going on. So the whole overarching theme, the little museum blurb said it was about a man running from time. And time's fleeting nature was a theme that Henson explored a couple times. And then ultimately he died young. He was the first of the Muppeteers to die. He was like 53 years old. So it's eerily prescient, kind of. But it's more than just that. I watched this, of all the ones, I watched this one a couple times this week. So he starts out in the hospital bed, like he's already had some kind of brush with mortality, some health issue. But then in the next arc, the main arc of the thing, it's like he goes through a work day and then he's out on the town and he's experiencing this like sexually provocative show. But it keeps like going between the dancer on the stage and like the rhythm of the dancer's body, it's like becoming other things that possess that same rhythm. And one of them is a skeleton. So for a little while, it's a skeleton doing the pole dancing. Pretty interesting. And always with that rhythm.
And there's some weird stuff there, too. Like it cuts to him painting an elephant.
Okay, so the elephant was explained as he's painting it pink. So pink elephants is a euphemism for being drunk or hungover. Mm. And so it cuts from them popping the champagne at the nightclub to the next morning, you know, after Pink Elephants.
Okay, I can see that.
Which is also the music number in Dumbo, Pink Elephants on Parade, when Dumbo and Timothy drink the beer.
Gotcha, yeah. We also see the Mona Lisa get assembled, and he shoots the Mona Lisa Why he shoots the Mona Lisa, not clear to me. Was that one explained to you, Brian?
No, I didn't understand that one, but that, I think, is one shortcoming of experimental film. It's like, sometimes maybe you should have some rules. Because if you're just doing things to do things, like, you gotta have the goodwill of your audience to follow along with you. And if you sabotage that too often, you might get lost.
To quote Louis C.K., you can't have nothing isn't. You can't have everything is. Otherwise, then you have crazy stuff everywhere. There's no rules. That's kind of how I feel sometimes about experimental film. And then the short finally ends with back in the doctor's office, except this time Henson is the doctor. So I can definitely see the themes of like the passage of time being unstoppable and Henson trying to grapple with controlling that, I guess, as a theme.
Oh, and you said it was wordless, but there is a word. He keeps saying, help.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
As he's running through this crazy day. But it's incessant. It never stops.
So I really like this one. I thought it was the most sophisticated and interesting of the five shorts that we watched. I'll also say he was more established in his career. It was his first film, but he had been doing a lot of TV stuff for like the better part of a decade at this point. More than a decade, actually, because he was 29 when this came out. So, and it debuted at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, premiered there. So how much does this work foreshadow or represent Henson's future work, and how doesn't it?
Well, it's pretty different from the Muppet stuff that you would think of, but he was always trying new things. And if he had lived longer, he would have tried even more stuff. But like, look at Labyrinth or Dark Crystal or the TV projects they did, Dinosaurs and The Storyteller and Fraggle Rock, Sesame Street. It was always like a multimedia thing. He was kind of cut from the same cloth as like a Walt Disney, I think.
Hmm. Right. Like this creator always pushing the boundaries. That said, you're right. It's not really like anything else that he does. Most of his stuff is very family friendly, or at least like kind of universal, whereas this one is definitely adult oriented. Like it's from the perspective of a grown man and it's got a lot of sexual imagery in it and there's like borderline nudity in it. And what's the legacy and reputation of this debut? I hadn't really heard of it till you put it on my radar, Brian. I don't know how much of a legacy it has, particularly since it doesn't really foreshadow his other stuff that much.
Right. Well, not much, but in that year, it got an Oscar nomination.
Oh, what? It did?
It was an Oscar-nominated short film.
Oh, man, I missed that. That's awesome. And I wonder how much of his stuff has been Oscar nominated. This is probably one of only a couple. Could probably look that up. But what would you say is your favorite work by Henson? Just The Muppets writ large?
Yeah, probably The Muppet Show, which is pretty broad. But I love, you know, it's a lot of music, a lot of guest performers, kind of established that you have one human celebrity in amidst all the puppets, which was what they would then carry on into movies like Christmas Carol and Muppet Treasure Island. And, I mean, even, like, the newer Muppets movies were pretty good, like the 2011 one, and haven't seen Most Wanted yet, but I think things changed a bit when you started losing Muppeteers, which was even pre-Christmas Carol. Like, Henson and Richard Hunt were already dead by Muppet Christmas Carol in 92, so.
Oh, wow. I mean, if you count Muppet Christmas Carol, that's probably my single favorite Muppet thing. But Sesame Street was very formative on me, as many people. And that actually debuted just a couple years after this came out.
And I really like Labyrinth, too. We might have to have a Labyrinth episode at some point. But that was an early movie for me that showed that you could do really remarkable things with film. You know, the main character steps out of her house into this like impossibly large fantasy maze. And it's all full of creatures, monsters of all shapes and sizes, and great puppetry. Always great puppetry with Henson. In fact, like after the Muppets got sold to Disney, there's still vestiges of the Henson company that goes and does puppetry on other projects. Highlights and lowlights, of course, we did talk about Turkey Hollow. But they're still out there. They're still doing it.
Wow. Yeah. Labyrinth is probably the one I want to check out next. Although he did do, just a couple years later, a live action film called The Cube. Have you heard of The Cube, Brian?
Whoa. I'll put that on my list for next.
And did I shout out Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas yet?
Not yet.
We talked about that one. You brought that one on, Brian, and I really liked that one.
A perennial favorite.
All right. On to the fifth great American mind we're going to be discussing today, Brian. And that is you, Brian. Brian Terrell.
Thanks for letting me do this, Dan.
Yeah. So your 2010 film you made in college called Undead Presidents, subtitled No Damnation Without Representation. What are you best known for, Brian? What's our experience with you? Well, you're you, so that's your experience with you. And obviously, I've known you since high school and really known you well. Definitely got to know you better after we both graduated and we started writing for the same blog. And then now, of course, the podcast for the past 4 years. So that's been a delight. But tell us a little bit about the making of this and what led up to you making this.
Okay. So I went to the College of William and Mary for undergraduate, 2008 to 2012. And in my freshman year, well, I've always liked writing. I've talked about in, say, the Read It and Weep episode that I've had some recognition for my writing at different stages. But in college, I really turned my focus specifically to film, somewhat inspired by James Rolfe on the internet, who ran a site called Cinemassacre and did all kinds of media about how he was really passionate about filmmaking and film history. And in particular, he did this little documentary called Cinemassacre 200, where we talked earlier this episode about what constitutes a short film. Is anything that you make a short film? And he, James Rolfe, was of the opinion that anything you made counted to your filmography. So like every single video he uploaded got a little tick, whatever the scope of it was. And so Cinemassacre 200 was in like 2009 or something, but it was the 200th thing that he had done, 200th film or video. And so he did this like 20-minute documentary about getting into film and like all the video projects he'd done since he was a kid. So watching that, I was like, oh, I should major in film. That should be the thing. Good venue to bring things that you write to life is to make them into movies. So then I took a couple film classes. The program at William and Mary was primarily like film studies focused, like academic and reading and analyzing films, less focused on the production side. There's only a few like really big name prominent film schools scattered around the country. But I did take the production classes that they offered, and Film 306 was the big one that everybody in this major took. Intro to production. And the structure of the class was that you did kind of like a midterm film and then a final project. So for the midterm film, I think I contributed to a script, which it was one about a superhero. It was nothing. It was less of a thing than Piranha 2. So I'm not going to talk about that one. I wasn't at the helm that time. But my thought was, okay, for the final project, because the setup of the class, when you're about to start these projects, everybody would come in with a pitch that they would pitch to the class, and then like two or three projects would get picked, and the class would split up into groups of like five to make these films. And my thought was, okay, for the final project for this class, I'm going to have a pitch good enough that I'm going to lead a team, and people are going to join my team and make my movie. So I was walking around Colonial Williamsburg and thinking about, okay, well, what is the film going to be? And I walked past this little burial vault where there were, like, not quite mausolea, but these elevated tombs where they were up above the ground. And I thought, what if it's a zombie movie but it's all colonial era American patriot zombies. And then I went in and pitched it, and people were excited about it. Specifically, the girl that I mentioned when I talked, Super 8, who wanted to know how does she be a zombie, just like Elle Fanning in that movie. It's like that she was on board. She was in the film and actually became the casting director for the film. And this is probably to date the only movie that I've worked on that we had like connections with the theater department of the school. And through this person who arranged the casting, like all the actors in the school turned out to audition for this thing.
Wow.
And so hopefully it's all right if I just ramble for a little while, because I do have thoughts about this film.
Yeah, keep going.
So for a long time, I've admired actors. I mean, I've been into movies, I've admired actors, but I've always been like a little bit reserved, a little bit shy to go out and be an actor. But I've always like looked up to them. And at William & Mary, there was this improv troupe that I've also always liked improv. Certain people like to dunk on improv, like it's stupid and you should have a plan when you go out and act. But I think it's funny. I've always loved Whose Line Is It Anyway? And I think the funniest people on campus were the people who were part of this improv troupe. And so who should I see when we open the door for the auditions? But the very first person in the line waiting to audition is the captain of the improv team.
Wow.
And so, like, I was riding high. And he ultimately was cast as the male lead of this film.
Ben.
Yes, Ben. So did you pick up what I was laying down in the naming of the characters, Dan?
Well, Barbara, I know, is from Night of the Living Dead, but is Ben also in a zombie movie?
Well, they're all Night of the Living Dead.
Okay, gotcha.
Ben is, Cooper is. Originally, there were even more characters. It was a longer script that I originally wrote, and then it got simplified a little bit.
Gotcha.
So then the production proceeded, and we shot it over a few weeks in November 2010, and then edited it. Let's, I guess, talk a little bit about the plot. And I think you wrote out a good summary, Dan.
Yeah, so it's, what, like 10 minutes, a little less than 10 minutes? Mm-hmm. 8 minutes, I think. So it takes place in Colonial Williamsburg, and there's two students, Ben and Barbara, and they're arguing about the importance of knowing history. Barbara's just kind of aced a history exam. And all of a sudden, they're accosted by a zombie George Washington. But they don't recognize him as a zombie. They think it's a living historical reenactor, because obviously you have reenactors in Colonial Williamsburg. And he nearly bites Barbara, but Ben manages to kill him by hitting him in the head with something. And they kind of panic. Like, what do we do with this dead body? Because they still don't know it's a zombie. And they decide to bring it up to the anatomy lab. I guess it's like a cadaver or something.
Right. My thought was that if you donate a body to science, nobody's going to ask questions. The anatomy lab is hard up for bodies, and they'll take it and not look too closely.
Pro crime tip from Brian. But I like this shot. You have on one door, like two doors next to each other, anatomy lab, and right next to it is robotics lab. And the robotics lab door opens and the scientist sees the body and he does a great like double take on it and decides to drag the body into the robotics lab.
One thing I would change about this film if I were to George Lucas special edition it is I just need close-up cut-ins of the two lab signs, because I've had people watch it and they don't follow what happened there, so I'm glad you understood.
Were you the director, by the way, Brian?
Yes, so I ended up directing this film. So really, my directorial debut, I also wrote it.
Yeah, because I noticed the credits didn't explicitly say directed by, so I was curious on that.
Right, so we went into it that the cameraman was kind of going to be the director.
Uh-huh.
And he was, so he's credited as director of photography. I'm credited as story by, and there's just nobody credited as director.
Alan Smithy.
Right. As it shook out, I would say I was the director.
Gotcha.
But a lot of help from Matthew Sonnenfeld, who is the nephew of Barry Sonnenfeld, the director of Men in Black.
Oh.
And Wild Wild West and a few other Will Smith movies. So he liked to talk about that he was related to Barry Sonnenfeld. I think he works in like stage theater these days, Matthew Sonnenfeld. But yes, so he was a big factor in the tech side of it. We shot in brand spanking new 1080, which back in 2010, you didn't see a lot of 1080.
Wow. So anyways, they drop the body off, gets pulled into the robotics lab. Now the students go back outside, but as soon as they go back outside, they find that it's a widespread zombie attack. A lot of like historical figures, colonial people, and they run and they take refuge in this nearby little shed. And there's somebody in there already, and he introduces himself as Cooper, a political pundit, which I thought was kind of funny. And he declares that what's going on is the founding fathers have risen in response to the rising prices of stamps and tea and sorghum and other stuff. So like we're reliving history. It's repeating itself. And he reveals that he personally has already taken down a zombie. In fact, it's Betsy Ross. But she promptly comes back to life and bites Cooper. You have some fun flag action in there. And the two students run off and they find that the dead historical figures are encroaching on them. We have a little bit of a fight scene. One of these zombies is played by you, Brian.
That's right. Also, I think important to point out that Barbara had to step up and dispatch the Betsy Ross zombie.
Right. Yeah, there's just some struggle about that. Can you actually kill history? It's finding some balance between Ben and Barbara. Barbara kind of idolizes the past and Ben is dismissive of it. And just when it seems like they're doomed, who should emerge but robot George Washington, which I had seen this before, but I had forgotten about the Washington pun. I really love that. It's the rebuilt body robot version of the zombie that they had previously destroyed. And he saves the students. He thanks them for honoring history. In particular, thanks Barbara, who was the one who aced her history exam earlier.
And then he shuffles off into the distance with his new arm cannon.
and that's how your short film Undead Presidents ends, Brian. So how much does this film foreshadow or represent your future work? And I guess I will reframe that as, what is your future work, Brian?
So I've had a few film shorts that I would highlight since then, and ideally I'm trying to get at least into like post-production. I don't know how much more I'll be directing. I will be directing some things for my upcoming thesis project for my master's degree, so I may drop some ideas about what that'll be. But real quick, so like each year since 2011, I've done William and Mary's 24-hour speed filmmaking competition, so that at least has given us some opportunities to make some more shorts. I think the best one, if you join our Discord, we will drop some links, would be called Finding Him, which is one that stars Dan. We were assigned the genre religious film, and it's about a cult of people who find spiritual realization looking for Waldo in the Where's Waldo books.
Honored to be a part of your filmography, Brian.
I think there's some really good lines. I'm biased. A lot of that movie was improvised, the Waldo religious film. And I was impressed with what everybody was able to come up with. When you don't see him, he could be anywhere. And I think that's amazing. Or, if you don't believe in the great good Waldo on high, what do you believe? I have one. That competition, very small pool of contestants, but I've won that twice. In 2015 with the science fiction comedy Hometown Earth, and in 2022 with the existentialist musical On the Clock. I will certainly link to those on the Discord.
Yeah, please do. And you can join the Discord at thegoodsfilmpodcast.com. There's a link to our Discord there. And we'd love to have you.
There was another longer short that I made when I was at William & Mary called Crossbones and Cobblestones, which is a pirate noir film.
Ooh.
So you might find something that you like in that one, Dan. I was most pleased with the character names in that one, because the protagonist is named Willis Slade, which is a tribute to both Philip Marlowe and Sam Spade. So, like, the very earliest draft, he was Philip Spade, and then it became... I knew a guy whose name was Will, and he said it was short for Willis, not William. So then it's like, okay, well, I got a Willis Slade.
Okay.
And the girl was Tracy Adler, which was a tribute to Dick Tracy and Irene Adler, who is Sherlock Holmes' love interest in one Sherlock Holmes story, and then, like, kind of disappears.
Oh, cool. Drop those in the Discord, Brian. That'll be good.
I will. And then I had a script in my graduate program, which is called The Lobsters at Beach Party Point. It owes things to teen beach films, including Teen Beach Movie, including
Beach Party. Yeah.
Including also, though, 50s monster films like Robot Monster and stuff of that ilk, which received the Best Screenwriting Award at the school. Again, a small pool, but I'm thinking that's what I will probably turn into my thesis project, is shooting some version of The Lobsters at Beach Party Point.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I'll definitely keep you in the loop about that.
Maybe I can make a cameo or something.
The story continues on.
That's awesome. Well, we will follow your career with great interest, Brian. The hosts of this podcast will.
And hopefully at least the audience of the podcast too.
Yeah, we'll keep you all posted. Or I at least invite Brian to. He's not required to, but he is more than welcome to share the progress on this pod as it goes.
Well, thank you for watching. Did you have any questions about Undead Presidents?
Do you keep up with any of the people in the cast?
Great question. Not really. I saw CJ Bergen not too long ago, who was Ben. I still see Facebook posts from them from time to time. So CJ Bergen right now is a lawyer in Richmond. And Michaela Rothschild, Facebook says, is a project manager in Boulder, Colorado.
Okay. Cool. Well, I think the time has come, Brian. We've talked about 5 films, and I think the time has come to ask whether they are good. So any other tidbits you'd like to drop on your process or your experience making that before we get to the rating?
One more. So the space that they hide out in where Cooper is with Betsy Ross. So the casting director, she had this abandoned building behind her house and she could get into it. So we went in there and we filmed the first bit of that scene. But then some neighbor saw us in there and, like, banged on the door and said, "That's condemned. You're not supposed to be trespassing. Get out of there." And so we couldn't finish the scene. And so all that remains is we have the shot of them, the exterior, where they go in through the door into this decrepit, creepy shack. And then suddenly they're in a noticeably different interior that's not that place. And it was like a garage that we found somewhere that we had permission to be in.
That didn't bother me at all. I barely noticed it. That's just movie magic.
That's right. But I was miffed because I was really excited that we were going to be sneaking around in this abandoned shack.
Yeah.
But we at least got the establishing shot.
Yeah. Very cool. So Is It Good is our signature section where we each give each movie a rating on our 8-point goodness scale, ranging from very not good, a 1 out of 8, to our masterpiece rating, toward a good, an 8 out of 8. So we'll go one at a time. And D.W. Griffith's The Adventures of Dolly from 1908. Is it good, Brian?
I'm going to give this one a 3 because it's certainly possible to follow along with it. I think it works as a cohesive film. Hard to judge such an early film against modern standards, just because from our perception, there's a lot that's lacking. No dialogue, no music. But I think it's effective. Certainly, it's like representative of D.W. Griffith's work on a very small scale. Doesn't have the epic scope. What about you?
I'm actually going to give it the same. I think there's a lot of promise in it for such an early film. And I think it's very compelling. But I think that, first of all, it's dark and, like, just kind of weird. Like, the whole child abduction plot and then, like, the horrible gypsy stereotyping. kind of pulls it down a little. But I do like how it's told without intertitles, and you can follow it very clearly. And there's lots of cool compositions and action. That's another thing that Griffith does. This usually has a signature action piece. The most famous one is like he did a real glacier rescue in, I think it's Way Down East, one of his other movies. That's pretty impressive. It actually looks kind of tame because it's not special effects. He's actually on a glacier, but that's what makes it so cool.
He's very into damsels in distress.
Yeah. And so I'm going to give this one a 3 as well, an upper end 3 probably. Moving on to Amblin. What would you give Amblin? Is it good, Brian?
This is tough. I kind of lost the plot a little bit. I don't think it needs to be as long as it is. But the photography is good. I wish I had a higher res version to watch. I just looked it up on YouTube and it was like a 240 version. So maybe it rises if I watch it again and get a better copy. But I'll give this one a 4. And some of that is just love for Spielberg. It's the name of his studio. So obviously he attached import to this one. What about you?
I'm at pretty much the same space as you, but I'm actually going to give it a soft 5 good. Just because I found it engaging with the characters and their chemistry, and you can kind of follow the little sketches as they're wandering down the road. And I thought the ending was really thought-provoking, and it's just nicely assembled. And I think it has resonance to it because it's an early short for Steven Spielberg with kind of all that anticipation in it, sort of, that to me made it feel like a little more than was actually there. But it's right on the borderline of being something you would watch on your own, I think. But I ultimately enjoyed it and thought it was pretty cool. Moving on to Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs short. So not the feature film, but the short from 1991. Brian, is this good?
This was so weird to me. I mean, now that I have seen the feature, a lot of it does take place all in one warehouse. So it's guys walking around a warehouse yelling at each other. So it's not too much of a stretch to see them on this more simplified version of the set. But Steve Buscemi is great. Quentin Tarantino is okay, but just the simplified scale of it, it really seems like this is your local theater troupe doing this. Like, you got the one star actor, but it's, I don't know, it's rough. I'm going to give this one a high 2. But I did ultimately end up liking the feature. I think I would probably give Reservoir Dogs the finished movie a 6. I think it's stylish.
Yeah, we're in pretty much exactly the same spot here too, Brian, because I would give the feature a 6 as well. Probably a high-end 6 to Reservoir Dogs, and also obviously a very important film. And then the short 2 or 3 is fine, because it's just a shabby little experiment. But I guess with the built-in of charm of having Steve Buscemi and seeing some of this dialogue delivered well, I'll tiptoe into 3 territory.
It's like they filmed a rehearsal. It's like they're standing behind the curtain about to go out on stage and they're going through lines.
Now, Jim Henson's Timepiece from 1967. Brian, is Timepiece good?
I really like this one. Largely because it was kind of a revelation to me. I had never heard of this at all. And then I'm seeing it broadcast on shown on a wall at a museum. And it's Henson himself in front of the camera, which didn't happen a lot. Pretty early in his career, but dealing with these themes of mortality and battling the clock, which I found really poignant. I'm going to give this a 6, just on the verge of a 7. What about you?
I'm going to go ahead and go right into 7 territory. I'm at pretty much exactly the same place as you. This is a pretty astonishing and compelling piece, the way that he uses the rhythm to tell the story. And you kind of get that it's like a commentary on the encroaching scariness of time marching ever onward inexorably, but with just this kind of playful energy to it. And just, it moves so fast. It's like less than 10 minutes long, or maybe about 10 minutes long, but it tells this whole story in really quick images that never feels overwhelming. It reminded me a little bit of Guy Maddin's, I think it's called The Heart of the World, from like the 2000s, which is a remarkable, possibly masterpiece level short by the Canadian filmmaker Guy Maddin. And that has kind of some of the same energy to it. I would imagine he has seen and had been at least somewhat inspired by Timepiece because there's some shared DNA there. I just think it's a remarkable piece of filmmaking that shows that Jim Henson, as much as we kind of associate him as the puppet guy, the Muppets guy, who did like all those Muppet and Muppet related things. He was just a remarkable talent and mind. So, yeah.
And there's a lot of really varied imagery in it.
100%. So,
like there's animation and a little bit of stop motion, I think. At one point, Jim Henson is flying in like a Da Vinci contraption. Like, it's never not interesting to look at.
Yeah, it's very cool. Also, a little bit of like the Wizard in Space and Time, which is another popular short that has also a sense of energy to it and like clever use of editing and practical effects and stuff. So, yeah. Now on to Undead Presidents. Should I rate this one first since you're the one who made it, Brian? Or are you even going to throw a rating on it?
Yeah. Well, I guess you can go ahead. You can be the first one, Dan.
So I'm going to give this one a very good, a 6 out of 8. It's impossible for me to think of it as a movie that is anything other than one made by my best friend. So I will just, obviously there's bias in there, but I get so much joy out of watching even like student made projects of things that are made by people I care for. You know, my daughter, when she makes stop motion stuff, you making your student film that has all the Brian storytelling and consideration in there. And even without my bias, honestly, it's a lot of fun. It's a fun little riff on a zombie movie with the whole Founding Fathers twist on it. That's kind of unique and clever. And I just had a really good time with it. Just a very delightful thing for me to watch personally, Brian. So I'm going to give this a very good.
Well, thank you. I'm going to give it a 5. I do think it holds up. I'm really glad to hear that you were able to follow the story. Like, elements of the presentation, I think, work well. The scientist leaning out of the door and pulling the body in, and some of the jokes with the sorghum and molasses. It's all about sorghum and molasses, and and the thing that they kill George Washington with is like his wooden teeth fall out of his mouth, and they hit him on the head with the wooden teeth. If I were to revisit this, I'd invest a little of money in the props and the makeup. But I think the central conceit is there, and I am excited to do something with this lobster script. So I'll keep you all posted.
Please do. So this has been kind of a sprawling survey, Brian, but I've enjoyed this. 5 great American minds, that's the theme here. But yet, debut month marches ever onwards. So what are we going to be watching next week for debut month, Brian?
All right. I get a pick now. I almost feel like I'm cheating because I tossed on one that I made in this episode, and now here I am going again picking the movie. But sometimes your directorial debut ends up being the only movie that you ever made. Our next film is one such case. It is Manos, The Hands of Fate, from fertilizer salesman Hal P. Warren in El Paso, Texas in 1966.
A movie famous for being, well, I don't know if bad's the right word.
I think bad is the right word.
Yeah, so I've never seen this, and I'm eager to, and eager to hear what you have to say about it, Brian. So that will be fun.
Good. We just recently had The Room and Plan 9, so I think it's only fitting.
We're collecting disaster pieces, Brian.
Thanks for joining, listeners.
Come find us on the goods, filmpodcast.com. We'll be dropping some multimedia in the Discord.
Bye, everybody.